Call the House State Affairs Committee meeting to order. Today is Wednesday, April 17th, 1991. The time is 8:43. We have a quorum today, Representatives Moyer, Choquette, Ruckman, Miller, and Covina. Today's meeting will take up House Bill 55 relating to Appropriation Budget Reserve Fund, HGR 37 relating to Alaska-Siberian Land Lease Program, House Bill 20 relating to Longevity Bonus Nursing Home Benefits, House Bill 122 relating to Qualifications for Longevity Bonus, and House Bill 257 relating to Alaska Highway Commitment Medallion. This time I'd like to take up for us House Bill 55 by Representative Brown, an act of appropriation to the Budget Reserve Fund, providing for effective date. We'll note that in your bill, files include a draft CS prepared by the bill's sponsor. At this time, I'd like to ask Representative Brown to join the table and brief us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Brown. Members of the committee. I want to say a few words about the proposed committee substitute for House Bill 55. At the time that I introduced House Bill 55, the session had just begun, and we did not know at that time what the projections would be for the amount of revenues available, either for 91 or 92. We now have a better idea of what the projected revenues available are, as well as what the House proposed spending plan is. And I've drafted a proposed committee substitute that I think is realistic and that will ensure significant savings of our surplus revenues, as well as accommodate the proposed budget plan that has been passed by the House. Mr. Chairman, before I begin the explanation of the specifics of this bill, I might just take a moment and give an overview of these budget reserve funds, the differences in them, and how they came to be there. We have two budget reserve funds. We have a statutory budget reserve fund that's created under 3705-540. This is tied to a statutory spending limit. Neither the budget reserve fund or the spending limit have been adhered to by the legislature, and this is one of the difficulties with this section of the law that led to the passage of the constitutional budget reserve fund. Briefly, Mr. Chairman, the statutory budget reserve consists of appropriations made to it, and it can be spent under the terms of the statute if the money available to spend is less than was than permitted under this statutory spending limit. The statute provides that up to 25% of the balance may be appropriated. As far as I'm aware, the budget reserve has never gone under that statutory scheme. This was adopted under Governor Sheffield. And my first year in the legislature, the entire amount of the budget reserve, statutory budget reserve, was used to meet a large shortfall. It was in the neighborhood of $500 million. It was all spent in one whack. Recognizing that each session of the legislature and each act of the legislature supersedes prior acts of the legislature, there isn't a way to make this scheme binding. And that's what led us last year to adopt the constitutional budget reserve and to place that before the voters in November. And of course, as you know, it was approved. Now, the constitutional budget reserve consists of all the money received by the state after July 1, 1990 as a result of the termination or settlement of oil or mineral related litigation shall be deposited into the constitutional budget reserve. And it can also consist of appropriations to it. The difference here in the restrictions on the expenditures out of the constitutional budget reserve are more stringent and will be enforceable. Because it is a constitutional provision, the legislature would not be able to override it with a statutory act, as we have done in the past with the statutory one. And basically it provides that if the amount available for appropriation for a fiscal year is less than the amount appropriated for the previous fiscal year, you can appropriate from the budget reserve with a simple majority. However, you can't appropriate more than the amount necessary to get back to last year's level. So with a simple majority, we could appropriate up to last year's level. For any public purpose, we could go beyond that with a 3/4 vote. So if we had a disaster or some compelling reason that we could get 3/4 of the legislature to agree to, we could appropriate more money than that out of the constitutional budget reserve. And the constitutional budget reserve now has about $283 million in it. The statutory budget reserve, on the other hand, now has a balance of zero, and it has an appropriation that was made in last year's budget that says the carry forward from 91 will go into the statutory budget reserve. And the original version of House Bill 5 would have just switched that from statutory to constitutional. The effects of what is proposed in the committee substitute, which acknowledges that the House budget plan would draw about $200 million of our expected $600 million carry forward to meet the FY92 budget. It would take a balance at the end of FY92 and split that half and half, half to the constitutional and leaving half in the statutory budget reserve. If there is, and that's provided in section one of the bill, of the proposed committee substitute, if there is any carry forward at the end of 92, as determined by the year-end report that the Department of Revenue prepares in October, that money would also be split half and half between the statutory and constitutional budget reserves. At this time, we don't project any carry forward at the end of 92, and in fact, we project needing to use reserves to meet the budget for 92. So if the oil prices for 92 average about 18 a barrel, we would be using $200 million in reserves. We would have $200 million in a constitutional budget reserve and $200 million in a statutory budget reserve. If oil prices in 92 are $16.50 a barrel average, we would have a balance of approximately $180 million, of which 90 would be in the constitutional budget reserve and 90 would be in the statutory budget reserve. Mr. Chairman, I commend this to you because I think it is important that we continue to, as we can, put a little bit away into the constitutional budget reserve. I see the constitutional budget reserve as being a significant tool available to us to help cushion the downside slide whenever it begins in earnest. And it's difficult to project, as we all know, when that day will come, but there's no doubt in my mind that it will come and that we will be grateful then for having used restraint on holding spending down as well as having managed to save some money to at least keep things from falling very severely in any one year, which would be the goal, to try to level out the spending on the downside as revenues decline. So that's an overview, Mr. Chairman, of how this proposal came to be before you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Only when we take out the constitutional budget reserve, at any point after that, years after that, that we have a surplus, it automatically goes back into that also?
Yes, that's correct.
Questions from the committee? Questions? Right. I'll accept the motion. Representative Breckman.
Thank you. I move that we accept the CS for House Bill 55. We should do that first.
Okay, the CS is before us. If there's no objections, there are no objections. We do have CS before us.
Yeah.
Basically, my thoughts on this is this bill could change or not go anywhere or be changed radically in the Finance Committee. Just as it was changed radically in our committee. And I really look at it as a vehicle. I'll probably be a no wreck on it because who knows how it's going to end up. But I'd want to move it to the Finance Committee.
So moved.
There is a motion to move CS for House Bill 55 with individual recommendations. Are there objections? If there are no objections, CS for House Bill 55 is moved to the committee. Thank you, Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very professional presentation.
Compelling.
Thank you. bill before us will be House Bill 20. House Bill 20 is an act relating to qualifications for longevity bonus payments and providing for effective date. Signed sponsor of House Bill 20 is Representative Sharp. Representative Sharp, would you join us at the table? We have heard this bill before, and we also heard it on our statewide teleconference on April 1st. Representative Sharp does have a sponsor substitute before us. Does anybody need a sponsor substitute? Raise your little pinkies.
Oh, anyway, I can look on the computer.
Do we have... Does anybody not have the official note for the CF?
Two fiscal notes, Mr. Chairman. One of them's zero, the other one's 84,000.
Representative, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate this bill being scheduled again, and thank you for that. I enjoyed the hearing sitting here at this table while you people were in Anchorage, and a lot of the sage testimony from some of the seniors up there.
It was a good hearing. I really enjoyed it.
I wish I could have been there to actually see them. They looked like they were steeped in years of experience.
Good one for me.
Mr. Chairman, this bill basically corrects what many feel it was a broad brush effect in 1985 that said that anyone residing in a nursing home did not receive a longevity benefit bonus. Let me explain what that means to about the 28 of them out of the total. That's a very small number of people in our state, but I believe that we should consider them. Basically, if you take a senior citizen that's lived in his own home all his life, taking care of himself, finally reaches a stage in life where he or she needs that extra help, taking care, providing for themselves as far as care, they are forced to leave their home and move into a nursing home. All other things being equal, they've provided for themselves out of their own funds at home. They're providing for themselves in a nursing home, paying the full tariff of whatever's charged, $5,000 to $8,000 a month. So the only thing that has changed is the physical location of where that person's residing. They went from their home to the nursing home. Only change. The problem is the present statute says once they move to the nursing home, they lose their longevity benefit bonus if they're 60, if they're eligible for it. There's been some mention that there's possibly a constitutional problem with this, but there is a Cameron Cook has a legal interpretation of some of the ramifications, and she quotes, from a constitutional standpoint, the disqualification of nursing home residents from receiving longevity bonus payments raises an equal protection question. Looking at the longevity bonus program in isolation, without regard to Medicaid eligibility, there appears to be no rationale relationship between the purpose of the longevity bonus program and one's status as a nursing home resident. So the existing statute may already be constitutional, but when you've only got 30 to 35 people affected, there's not much social push for legal action on their behalf. So what this bill proposes to do is just add a section B that clarifies people residing in nursing homes, and it establishes, it would say that they would be eligible to receive a longevity bonus payment if the cost of care of the person residing in the nursing home are paid entirely from their own private sources, of which about 28 of them are, as long as they meet the age and residency requirement for longevity benefit bonus. This bill would correct the law that was changed in 1985, which by a broad brush approach made all nursing home residents ineligible for longevity bonus payments. Care for many nursing home residents is borne entirely by the state and federal government. It is not unreasonable logic that longevity bonuses be withheld from individuals receiving subsidized nursing care. A retainage of these funds helps the state offset its share of this heavy health care, which is 50% of the Medicaid. But there's a small percentage of nursing home residents who pay their total nursing home charges that range from $5,000 to $8,000 a month. This legislation is designed to correct this discriminatory disenfranchisement action. If any elder citizen deserves a longevity bonus payment, I would think that it would be these that are standing the financial crunch of trying to maintain a self-sustaining status. According to a November 1990 survey of all nursing homes in Alaska, which is this one here, there are only 36 self-paid patients out of a total of 614. Based on this data, it appears that approximately 80% of those 36 are 65 or older and would be eligible for the longevity bonus. So we're talking 28 to 30 people as of the information from that survey, which they think is typical. The maximum estimated annual increase in the longevity bonus program cost, according to the fiscal note, is estimated between $75,000 and $90,000. I think it's $84,000 on the one here. It's also a fair assumption that a majority of these funds would eventually be used to continue the self-pay option for the few that are in there. Not by very many more months, $5,000 a month, but only $250 receiving a month from the longevity bonus. But it would be some help. Now, that fiscal note actually is a little large if one takes it in context. HB 11 passed out of this committee, which would assume the first 30 days of that if that bill passes. So those fiscal notes of those two bills overlap, my bill and HB 11, which would amount to an overlapping of between $6,000 and $10,000 annually on that. I'd also like to point out that, as many of us know, that the state spent for longevity bonus hold harmless in 1991, $6,594,000. And next year, I think we've got budgeted about $7,803 for the longevity benefit hold harmless. Now, this is general funds to reimburse federal programs, thereby allowing the persons on public assistance and Medicare and so forth to continue getting their longevity bonus. It would seem that this legislation would correct a situation that possibly was inadvertent in the law, and I think it is something that's fair and should be done. What brought it to my attention was a 95-year-old man in Fairbanks finally having to go into the nursing home there. Was paying his own way for 18 months before he passed away, and the first month he was in there lost his longevity bonus. He lived here in Alaska practically all his life, and it was a little devastating to think that he would lose that because he just happened to move from home 5 blocks down the street from nursing home. So that's the purpose behind the bill. And it adds paragraph B to the existing statute that clarifies nursing home residents, if they're not getting governmental funds,
Thank you, Representative Sharp. Are there questions of Representative Sharp in the committee? Hearing none, Representative Sharp, maybe just slide over. I'd like to ask Barbara Baffney to come and join us. And maybe just, is there another chair back there, or pull one of those chairs up, can we? Barbara, state your name and position for the record, please.
Yes, my name is Barbara Bassoni, and I'm the director of the Division of Family Benefits.
Thank you. Could you explain to me your and your fiscal note statement? Did I do that? The division questions if this bill is constitutional. Would you explain that statement, please?
We were concerned that those people who are in a long-term care facility and who are not paying or getting their funds paid by somebody else, why wouldn't they be able to get the longevity bonus? It's not an equal treatment between two groups of people. And that I could not answer. If the people who are fully paying private care or those who are paying veterans care, why wouldn't they be equally eligible under this bill?
maybe Representative Grunberg can add something to this, but it seems like if the state is paying for people to be there, like through Medicaid or our share of those kind of funds, and we're not paying for these people over here because they have private insurance, would seem like that would be enough of a distinction to allow them to do it.
The question came up from, especially from federally funded programs, Medicare and veterans, for the first few months veterans were paid for that.
Let's see. Anything from the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would have to agree with Representative Sharp. I think Ms. Cook over in the legal says maybe the whole system we have now is unconstitutional, and this may be a direction to bringing it, some of it back towards that direction. I mean, the whole program as we have it now constituted by taking all those folks out may be unconstitutional. And I view this as a fairness issue as much as that. I mean, the guy moves five blocks and he's paying his own cab. Just because a move of residency from one place to another should not deny him his longevity bonus.
Barbara?
Yeah. The department supports the bill. On the fiscal note may possibly be lower than $84,000. What this is an estimate in time and place where we called all the private facilities. Not everybody will stay a whole year. Many people would stay less. We do not have the statistics to base any more accurate data from how long will they actually stay.
Okay.
So this is the maximum what we think the state would pay under this bill.
Any other questions for Ms. Baffin?
No, thank you, Ms. Baffin.
Gordon, do you have anything to add?
No, sir. I'm just available for questions about the whole harmless portions of Medicaid.
Thank you. Ms. Palmquist, you testified on this bill once. Would you like to add something? If so, come down and...
this morning, I'm representing older persons, actually.
Would you state your name for the
record? My name is Rose Palmquist, with the statewide organization called OPAG. We support the bill, and we were very concerned as to the interpretation of private non-governmental. And the first thing I asked Mr. Sharp was whether I'm, for instance, receiving Social Security. I consider that my fund and not a governmental fund, although I'm getting it from a program of the federal government. And he felt that that would not be considered to be a governmental fund. I would counter to Ms. Bathoni's testimony that a veteran who has served the United States has a similar earned program through the Veterans Administration, and I would consider that similar to the Social Security that I am receiving, or a state pension, which I just recently applied and am receiving. Those are paid through governmental programs, but we want them to be interpreted as non-governmental funds.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Palmquist. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Bruckner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you receive Social Security and pension checks, et cetera, they're issued to the individual, aren't they?
Yes.
Okay, so they wouldn't. They aren't sent to the nursing home and paid to the nursing home. They're paid to the individual who then chooses what to do with it.
The individual may have his check go to the nursing home, but it is his check in the care of the nursing home. And the same is true with the Pioneers Home.
Okay. I would think that's private funds then. It is issued to the individual. And it's not governmental funds. But I don't know if
you're right. Right, I see your distinction.
Right. I don't know.
The other thing is we can do anything we want until somebody challenges it in court. Representative Grunberg.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, it may be that you'll want to eliminate the word non-governmental.
Thank you, Ms. Palmquist.
Thank you.
And you get the question.
Ready for motion?
Well, what do you think about moving that removing the word non-governmental out of there.
First, we have to accept this bond, so substitute it then.
Bert, do you have any?
I don't really have any heartburn over it. It was put in there by drafting to, they thought clarified the term private board, but I think private funds is pretty clear to me, but I...
All right, I'll accept the motion on the CS, or this, no, this is a sponsor substitute, so it was read across on the floor, is that correct?
Yeah.
So we have a sponsor substitute before us. Is there a motion to amend?
So moved.
Representative Grunberg? Representative Bruckner?
So moved, that we remove the word non-governmental.
There is a motion to remove the word non-governmental at end of line seven. Are there objections to that? Hearing no objections, the word non-governmental has been removed. Any other discussion? The motion, Representative Baker.
Propose to remove HB 20. So they have to recommend it.
Yeah, you're right. We need a motion now to have a CS because we amended it, or you could say yes. Amended it. No. You need
CS.
Okay, we do have a CS then before us. And
with individual recommendation.
And there is a motion to move. A CS responsive substitute for House Bill 20 out of the committee with individual recommendations.
Compliments to the chef.
Are there any objections? Hearing no objections, CS for House Bill 20. Thank you, Representative Next bill I'd like to hear is House Bill 122, an act relating to qualifications for longevity benefits and providing for effective date. Prime sponsors, Representative Taylor. Representative Taylor. We have heard this bill also before. It was, I believe we heard it here in committee, and we also heard it on April 1st on our statewide health conference. Representative Taylor?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing this legislation and for giving it another opportunity. The thrust and purpose of this legislation is fairly simple, and I know the committee, having been through some of this before, will appreciate it if we just go quickly to the essence of the question, and that is whether or not seniors who leave the state of Alaska for more than 30 days should be deprived of their longevity bonus check if, in fact, the cause or the reason for leaving the state was a medical one. It's probably does not occur quite as frequently in the Anchorage and Rail Belt area as it does in my area of southeast Alaska, but significant medical treatment is often sought in this area by going to Seattle, and in fact, or the Pacific Northwest, I should say. Bellingham now has some fine facilities. Many people also go to Portland. But it's been very common in this area for a lengthy period of time that the local physicians will often refer patients to expert assistance in the Northwest area. And what usually happens is, especially anymore, because all doctors and hospitals, I think, try to work as conscientiously as they can about keeping the patient out of the hospital, you'll very frequently end up being sent down to some expert in Seattle at the Mason Clinic or wherever, University of Washington Hospital. And the doctor will see you and treat you and then have you placed as an outpatient and say, I want you to come back 2 weeks from now for more tests. So you come back in for more tests and evaluation. And then the doctor says, now we'd like to see you 10 days from now and then 5 days after that. Now, maybe you're going to make it back home in 30 days. Maybe you're not. The way the law currently reads, it doesn't matter why you're out of the state. If you're out of the state for 30 days, you're cut off. Now, you requalify under current practices by having a doctor sign a slip that says, yes, though your absence may have been extended beyond the 90-day period, which would terminate you for one full year, you can requalify by having a doctor sign a slip that says, yes, you were out for medical treatment for a major portion of this absence, and therefore you don't have to wait the full year to come back into the system again.
And yet one of the excuses offered by the department for not allowing seniors this their bonus checks during periods of medical problem is that a doctor would sign a slip. Well, it seems ludicrous to me that we would accept that doctor's slip to requalify people, because if you really wanted to save money, you could keep them out of the system for a year by saying, no, the doctor's slip doesn't count. It seems odd to me that we would say it on the one hand, that we will use a doctor's slip to requalify you if you've been out for more than 90 days, but we would run into huge amounts of fraud and misuse if we use the same doctor's slip to justify a continuation of payment beyond the 30-day period. That's the essence of the legislation, Mr. Chairman. I think many people have concerns about two issues, and the two issues are fraud and the misuse of this system. I think the assumption is made, which I believe is a fallacious assumption, that extensive fraud and misuse will occur. When asked the department, when we asked them what was the extent of the fraud that they've experienced in the past, their answer was they had four in 1991. And those are people they have terminated from receipt of the benefit. They've never prosecuted anyone under the criminal sanctions for fraud. So fraud cannot be a real big problem if we're only running into four in the last year. And the questions as concerns the fiscal note and the extent to which people who are today potentially disqualified, who may then come back into the system because of this, I think are very weak numbers. The reason I do is because they're taken out of Department of Labor statistics and then a guesstimate is made as to how many of those people might somehow qualify, and I think those guesstimates are very high. On the fiscal note, they state that their assumption is based on the number that 50% of the bonuses that are currently forfeited would be paid under House Bill 122, and that 20% of the additional Alaskans who do not now participate in the program would join up. That's where the numbers come from to get you to a $1.8 million fiscal note this year, up to a $2.3 million fiscal note in 1997. There's no question there'll be a slight increase, but I don't think anyone can honestly sit before us and tell us what that number will truly be, even within a few percentage points of what that number will truly be. I wouldn't try to suggest to the committee what it may be. I submit to the committee that it's going to be less than what is guessed at here, because I believe the people making the guesstimates are working under a very simplistic system at this time that basically says, we don't care what the reason is. We don't care if you're down there for chemotherapy, like one of our own members has had to go south for extended periods this year. We don't care if you're down there for any reason. You're there more than 30 days, you're off our system, we just save money. And while we're on the subject, I got one other item I want to bring to your attention that came to my attention just because of filing this bill. Right now, if you sign up for your longevity bonus, you're waiting 2 months before you get your first check after you turn age 65. Can anybody find me in the law where it says, after you turn age 65, thou shalt wait 2 months? And nothing in there says they should wait 2 months. In fact, the excuse is, well, that's how long it takes to process the application. Well, the strange thing is, I have constituents in my district that are filing their application a couple months in advance to make certain that everybody will have the paperwork there in time. It's not considered until the date comes up, then they wait 2 months. So you ask yourself, well, since they were qualified for those first 2 months, what happens to the money? Well, quote, the department saves the money to the extent that it isn't paid until they die. Those two checks then go to the heirs. I didn't think we were setting up a fund around here that was supposed to pay money to heirs when people died. I thought it was supposed to be supposed to continue to live here among us and be with us. Now, I think those, if nothing else...
That's not in the building.
No, but if nothing else, we should at least have the committee look into that, address it, and maybe... well, with intent language someplace in the budget that suggests that they no longer take 2 months to process those things and deny them the checks. That's all I have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Minority Leader.
I should have noted for the record that Representative Baker came in about just a couple minutes after we started, and also Representative Broomberg. Questions of sponsor from the committee? Representative Bruckner.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have questions, and I apologize. I had to leave for a few minutes there. I support this bill. I think people have to leave for medical reasons. They should certainly be able to. And I've heard some rumors that folks will have a doctor just quickly excuse them for not valid reasons. And I don't believe that's to be totally true. So I just want to lend my support to this because I think medical absences are certainly valid and always it should continue.
Representative Shilkat.
Mr. Chairman, I have some questions of Barbara.
We'll bring her up just a second. Anybody have anything on anything else? Representative Taylor. Representative Taylor, why don't you slide over a little bit and we'll bring Bethany back. Barbara, we do have your fiscal note. We have your statement. We've also I've heard you testify on this bill before, so I think that I understand the department's position. Do you have anything to add to what your position has already been?
No, not at this time.
Okay, Representative Shilkat.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Barbara, in your fiscal note, your position paper, you spend a paragraph discussing the problems with defraud or possible defraud, and I would suggest that it's very easy to, or not very easy, but defraud is possible in just about any of the programs that we have. And as far as I'm concerned, this the job of this committee and this legislature is not to criticize something because of the possibility of defraud. That has to stand on its own merit in terms of a person doing right or doing wrong and our ability to enforce the actions if something does happen. You have on your position paper stated solely on that attempt, but you have not stated whether the department supports, does not support, is neutral, or opposes this bill. You have a fiscal note that, as far as I can determine, Barbara, is just a shot and a guess and something that brings you to believe that this many people will take advantage of this. My questions are, two, what is your position on the bill? And second, how did you arrive at the $1,835,000 for 92? $1,878,000 for FY 92.
Ms. Bethany.
Mm-hmm. The department's position is that they will not support the bill because of the cost. The commissioner's position is that section on your bill analysis, which is the program effects, which is a possibility of defraud. Since this bill has come up, we also asked people if they came back from vacation, you know, or were out of state, for what reason. We don't always know what the reason, but since we've asked, we realize that a lot of people go out of state, not just Southeast. And I know there are hundreds and hundreds of people who go out who are not what we call bad apples, who go out for a reason because of long-term treatment, and they need that treatment. Plus, they're getting it for less expensive. Plus, the state insurance encourages that. So I realize that there's a great number of people, much more than we think, who are going out of the state to receive treatment. So it's not just because we think it's a possibility to defraud the system. That statement came because that's our greatest workload, is trying to justify, is this a medical reason or not? We get the craziest statements from various languages. Oh, I had to get my chiropractor said I couldn't travel. From five different countries? I mean, I could give examples over examples. The problem with the bill is that it will be extremely difficult to administer. I just want to give you an example. Unless it is clarified that if a person has to have a physician statement from here, a referral, maybe that's one way to go. But we have people who leave the state, plan to go on vacation in October. In November, they go see a doctor and they suddenly they're told they have high blood pressure. They're supposed to have it checked every 2 weeks. They stay out until April. We have that. We have hundreds of people who have statements where the doctor says they should leave the state because they would be feeling better in a warmer climate. The differentiation between that kind of physical physician statement and those who need a really very valid people who need the treatment, the cancer treatment, and I know a lot of these people. It's very difficult to make, but the percentage who goes out for 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, many of them seek medical treatment in the lower 48 during that time. But they tell us when they come back, and I talk to them on the phone. So that's the reason why we came up with a rather large number on the fiscal note. How I came up with the fiscal note is I looked at the absences, and there are not that many people. There are only a total of 200 plus 400 from the existing program. I only looked at 600 people out of 22,000. If we look at that percentage, it's not such a great number. But from our records of people going out and like, you're right, there are estimates, because we don't have the type of backup. But from the responses we get when we ask, and the paperwork we get on justifying the excess of 90 days, very large percentage seek medical treatment while they're out, and a whole variety of medical treatments.
One problem I have is that if the more you increase the cost, the more pressure there's going to be to get rid of the program altogether. Mm-hmm. Representative Taylor.
Yeah, we inquired through Paulus Garvey of Legislative Research. We received a response from Bruce Aronson of Longevity Bonus. His answer was, you've asked for the number of recipients absent from Alaska due to medical reasons. This office has not and does not collect such statistics. And regardless of the reason for being absent from Alaska, recipients are not paid if gone longer than 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
That's your office.
Right. We don't have accurate statistics.
And if we don't have statistics, mm-hmm. then you're testifying on your speculation based upon your experience. I appreciate that, Mike. My concern is you're testifying about those people who may misuse the system. My concern here is about, aren't you aware of literally as many people that have very valid reasons for being down there? And why in the hell should we cut off the Alaskan who at that moment in their life needs this check more than any other time? Because you're worried about somebody who might be phony the thing up.
No, I'm not worried about those who go out. I know there's a large number of people who go out and seek medical care. I know that. And they tell me when they come back. But there are also a large number of people who would go out there and go not for the cancer treatments, but could go to a chiropractor or for arthritis where they could live possibly the same way here.
And you can think of no way to assist in accomplishing the purpose of this legislation. So in essence, what you're saying is, let's kill the innocent right along with the guilty. Let's make certain we cut off every Alaskan that actually has a very valid reason for being out there, because we're afraid some Alaskan might misuse it. So let's make it simple to administer. We'll cut them all off.
Well, what about if you had to pre-qualify somebody who was for services that were not available?
That was in regulations, I think 3 years ago. And because of a person has a choice to go someplace, why should a person from Ketchikan have to go to Anchorage where they could get better or equal care in Seattle? And we had problems with that in the past. We went to some hearings on that. It is very difficult. I am not against paying for those people, because you're right, they need that money at the hardest time. The administration's position is if any bill costs additional money in the longevity program, they will oppose it. That's Commissioner Keller's statement.
Representative Moyer, did you have a question?
Well, I think you just hit upon it. You said pre-qualified. Barbara earlier said some kind of referral might be a solution.
Some way that we catch and we will be able to pay all those people who are, and that we could make it possible that we limit it to those people.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, we suggest that it might be possible that we mandate, this is a concept. take no pride of authorship. Anyway, we want to amend or change it, I'm happy with, as long as the concept gets accomplished. And maybe, and I think the chairman came up with an excellent idea about some form of pre-qualification or referral. I had never thought in terms that Barbara raised of Alaskan going south, going to a physician and getting a physician down south to say, well, the reason the guy's here is because he's having this problem. My thought had been primarily of the patients that I'm aware of that go into the same doctor they've been going to for 30 years, 40 years. The doctor says, I'm sorry, I can't help you on this one, Joe, I got to send you out. Well, that doctor ought to be able to send a notice to the agency at the request of the patient saying, I had no choice as a physician, I needed a referral to go out on this one. And that one ought to be taken care of. It ought to take a real emergency situation for a guy to be off on vacation. I can see that one happening too. He's off on vacation, plan to come home, he has a heart attack, he's a little golf course or something. But he's going to be a while coming back too. But there ought to be a way to filter those things without just using the sword of Damocles. That's all I'm saying.
Mr. Ripson, shut that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't think I'd be feeling so strongly against a decision by the administration on this bill that Representative Taylor suggested. We have a problem in front of us that, for all practical purposes, is a real problem that I can't understand the administration's stance on increasing the longevity bonus, because what we're trying to address with this bill is a method of providing a degree of fairness for those people that need the help. As a point of suggestion, Mr. Chairman, I think that maybe we could expand the definition of medical treatment. I understand what you're saying about having to go out to a chiropractor and going back a few days to get your back straightened out. That, in my mind, does not justify it, primarily because we have adequate chiropractors in the state of Alaska. I'm equally concerned about people in Ketchikan. It's going to cost them a heck of a lot more money to go to Anchorage for treatment than it is to go to Seattle. Mm-hmm. And if the state's paying that airfare through Medicaid or whatever way, it's going to cost the state a lot more money to send them up to Anchorage than it does send them to Seattle. So my suggestion to this committee, I like this bill. I don't think that we can put this bill to sleep because of the possibility of fraud. Is there any way that we can tighten this bill up so that it does address the major concerns? The one suggestion that I have is, for the purpose of receiving medical treatment, maybe we can expand on that medical treatment, and maybe we can require a pre-agreement or something along the lines of what you were talking about, Gene. I think it's wrong for any representative of the people to push anything aside for the chance of fraud. I think that's a cop-out.
If the committee doesn't object, I'd like to hold this bill for a couple more days, put it in a small subcommittee, see if we can come up with a CS and bring it back to us at the earliest possible date. Is your objection?
No objection.
Do I have volunteers to serve on the subcommittee, potential cat?
Well, thanks, guys.
Work with you, Representative Taylor.
Oh, sure. Would you put Representative Ruffin on the team, please?
She expressed support.
She expressed support.
And I'll also serve on that.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Mary Lou, does AARP support that bill?
Yes, sir, they do. They don't have a formal position on it, but
Next item on the agenda is HGR 37, a resolution by Representative Moyer that recognizes the 50th anniversary of the Alaska-Siberia Lend-Lease Program of World War II. Representative Moyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate you hearing this resolution. Excuse me. It's one that Representative Foster and I considered, and it would basically honor the efforts
The committee that's been formed to promote the reunion of Alaska Soviet Lend-Lease Program participants from 50 years ago, a copy would simply be sent to them, and they have quite an impressive portfolio of letters and such from other notables that they use when they try and raise funds for their efforts, including the son of the founder of IBM, the former ambassador to Moscow, I should say the Soviet Union, Thomas Watson, who later, during his tenure as ambassador, re-flew the route over, as he had done back in World War II in his own private aircraft. One of the first instances the Soviet Union allowed private aircraft in, in their country. The Lend-Lease program was an example of the kind of cooperation our two countries had before the Cold War began, which has only recently dawned. Thousands of, if not millions of Soviet lives were probably saved by the 8,000 plus aircraft that the United States leased to the Soviet Union, flying them from a route from Montana up through Whitehorse, Fairbanks, and what is now Fort Wainwright, then Ladd Field, where the Soviet pilots picked them up and ferried them the rest of the way through Nome. I think it was a goodwill program then, and now in coinciding with the 1992 festival, there's a reunion planned. Our pilots have already been over to the Soviet Union. And I should say the other way around. Their pilots have been here in 1990. We plan to go there in 91, and then in 92 there'll be a reunion in the states and the various cities. With that, Mr. Chairman, it's a pretty straightforward resolution. I'd be glad to answer any questions. I'll leave it at that.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the resolution.
Any objections?
Individual recommendations.
Thank you. The more I talk, the more I thought.
HJR 37 has moved. And if you don't mind, I'll put my name on that,
sure. You can put my name on it. It's certainly not. Maybe not.
The next item before the committee is House Bill 257 by Representative Broomberg relating to a medallion commemorating the 50th anniversary of construction of Alaska Canada Highway.
I'd like to call the committee, Mr. Chairman.
I am bringing this bill before us for the purposes of officially having its first meeting, as indicated. Further discussion this morning indicated this bill needs some more coordination with Canada. And so if nobody has any objections, we'll just hold on to this bill at this time. Monday we have Millet Keller.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to bring the committee's attention to Representative Miller's socks.
Representative Miller's socks?
Could you show him your socks, please? Hey, Representative Miller. This is the color
nice
you do.
Kind of socks in anywhere.
For a shower when you go, it's going to be a boy or a girl. Take your blue eye. I like it, Mike.
I should have worn some by one.
The next meeting of the House Committee will be Friday, April 19th, 1991. At that time, we'll be hearing Senate Bill 136 relating the Alpine Highway commemorative license plate, Senate Joint Resolution 9 relating to federal grant to state veterans' homes, Senate Bill 131 relating to notice of elections, meetings, and regulations. Forewarned on that one. It'd be interesting. And again, I'd like to remind everybody, Millet Keller next Monday, and the week after that is Department of Public Safety.
No, next Friday. Monday and Friday, isn't it?
No, Monday and Monday.
Millet.
We also have gotten, did we get Jack Anderson?
Yes.
Mr. Anderson, we expect the Anchorage people to be able to be doing some homework on Mr. Anderson.
Did you receive my memo, Mr. Chairman?
Well, I haven't seen him if he did.
No. I sent it over to you yesterday.
Yeah, we'll get it there. Also, we had some other appointments. Let's have those before us on Friday so that we can review with the committee. And if we want to hear anybody else, I think we had a judge or a personnel board or something. So let's have that list before us on Friday so we can just review and see if we need to actually meet with them. Okay?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Nice meeting you.
We're adjourned. 9:40.
What are you going to do?